In this first hour of the show, we will be looking back to last year's presidential election and also looking ahead to George Bush's second term in office. And we have, as the guest in this part of the program, Evan Thomas. He is assistant managing editor at Newsweek magazine and has been since April of 1991. He has guided the magazine's overall coverage. He has written more than 100 cover stories. Before becoming managing editor, assistant managing editor, he was the Washington bureau chief for a time. He has written several books, including biographies of Robert Kennedy and the Revolutionary War naval hero John Paul Jones, also one about the Clinton administration titled Back from the Dead, How Clinton Survived the Republican Revolution. And he is also responsible for overall the coverage of politics these days. And one of the things that the magazine does is a year before each presidential election, they take four reporters and they put them full time covering the campaigns of the Republicans and the Democrats. And of course, their stories are included in the magazine as time goes along. But also, after the election, they publish a major edition of the magazine that takes a look back at the campaign. If you did not see that when it was published in the magazine, it is available in book form with a little bit of additional material. It's titled Election 2004, How Bush Won, and What You Can Expect in the Future. It's published by Public Affairs, available in paperback, and is out there in the bookstore now if you want to take a look at it. Of course, as we talk this morning with Evan Thomas, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, but anybody is welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455. That's the local number. And toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Thomas, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
I appreciate it. Immediately after the election, there was a lot of conversation and debate about what the election meant, particularly a lot of soul-searching among Democrats, trying to figure out what happened to them and why they lost. And I'm sure that settled down some, but has not completely gone away. The president, right after the election, it was very clear that he and his advisors felt the fact that he had won was an endorsement of his policies. At the same time, there were Democrats who were quick to point out that all those people who voted, 48%, voted for Mr. Kerry, and that if he'd managed to pick up something like 100,000 votes in Ohio, he would be the president today. So given all of that, are people still talking about what this election meant, and has anybody offered a convincing answer?
Well, it is funny that, you know, the president claims a mandate based on 51% of the vote. I mean, only in a democracy can you do that. And I do think that some of the Democratic hand-wringing about it being the end of the world is a little bit misplaced, given the fact that they got 48%. And as you say, you know, 100,000 would have changed the result, and just in Ohio alone. Having said that, one thing about Bush is that one of his things about his style is he just declares things, and he believes that if you express confidence, if you say it so, then you can make it so, that is part of leadership. He's not somebody who wants to negotiate a lot, who wants to give away. He never concedes error. That's just his style, and who knows what he really believes. You know, when he wakes up at 4 a.m., does he really think that he has this huge mandate to go forward, or does he think, I just have to show that I believe this, whether or not I do? So it's hard to read his mind, but that's certainly his style, and the Democrats, I think, still are on their heels trying to regroup and figure out what's going on, and we're just at the beginning of the second term.
Are there any Democrats now who look back and say, you know, if we had just had candidate X, you know, fill in the blank, this other person, that we would have done better?
Well, it's hard to think who candidate X is. I mean, I think Kerry was a flawed candidate, and I wrote this in the book, and I think that because of the reporting of the Newsweek reporters, we showed it. He made a lot of mistakes, and his campaign staff made a lot of mistakes, and I think maybe another candidate could have beaten Bush. But I'm hard put to say who. I mean, Edwards, maybe, but I don't think he was all that great on the stump. There is no obvious other choice who could have stormed a victory. I think if Kerry himself could have done it if he had done a few things differently.
How significant do you think it is now that the DNC has chosen Howard Dean to be the head?
Well, you know, when I first heard that Dean was running and was considered to be a front runner back in late November or December, I was in disbelief. I thought, I just can't believe the Democrats would stick him in there, given that he had seemed to self-destruct in January of 04, and because there is a kind of a stridency to Dean. I was on a panel with him at Yale in November and watching him. You know, people talk about Bush's smirk. Well, it's nothing like what Dean has got. Dean has a smirk that is just very kind of smug and complacent. So I sort of didn't take it seriously. But one thing about Dean is he is a fighter. You know, he really is a fighter, and he just got in there and he hung in there. He's also, and this is going to be helpful to him, essentially a fiscal moderate or conservative. So he's not as lefty as he appeared to be during the presidential campaign. And he is also obviously good at raising money on the internet, which is something that the Democrats want to do. So my opinion has softened here. I think he's a more credible DNC chair than I initially imagined possible. But having said that, I still have some basic doubts. I mean, Dean is by his nature a bit of a rabble rouser. Is that what the party's looking for? I don't know.
Mm. When you ask a question like why it is that one man wins, another loses, and I expect there are a lot of ways to answer it, but it also seems to be that you begin and you end with the candidate himself. You hope that voters are going to make their decisions on some kind of careful consideration of policy and what the candidates say that will do, but it also seems that at the end of the day, that personal impressions of the candidate, your gut reaction to that person as a person, has a lot to do with it. And in this particular case, do you think that it was a case of personality over politics, and people were making their decision based on just their perception of what kind of a guy George Bush is and what kind of a guy John Kerry is?
I think dramatically so. I mean, everything that you just finished saying is generally true in presidential elections, but it was even more so, I think, in this case. And there's something puzzling and perplexing and kind of saddening about Kerry. Kerry, I believe, to be a decent guy who has served his country in all sorts of ways by getting shot at and all through his life. You know, he's a guy who could have cashed in, could have gone a different route, has always done the hard thing. I think his heart is often in the right place. He's both physically and mentally brave, all these good things. And yet there's something about him that people just don't cotton to. You know, they just don't relate to. They think he's not comfortable in his own skin, or he's a phony, or he's too pompous, or there's just something hard to put your finger on that is alienating. I mean, not obviously not to everybody. The guy did get how many million votes? I forget the total, but it's within the, you know, 50-some million votes. But there clearly was something that people just didn't like about him. And by the same token, President Bush, although you can criticize him for being arrogant and even not very smart, he does get criticized for that, or being inarticulate at least, there was just something about him that people liked. I mean, there just was a quality about him, maybe partly because he was a little bit inarticulate, that seemed like a regular guy and that people could relate to. And I hate to be so crude about it, but in some ways it was, you know, Bush, regular guy, we can relate to him. Kerry, not regular guy, we can't relate to him. And that, I know that's a sort of a raw measure for casting a vote, but people do cast their votes for pretty intangible, visceral reasons, and I think that's a factor here.
Well, that always, the knock on Kerry always was that he was stiff, he was remote, he seemed to have a difficult time explaining his ideas in simple terms, the way that people could relate to, that he had a hard time relating to people other than those of his class. And that seemed to come across in what we saw of him in the media. It also seems, if you take a look at the kind of things that your reporters have written, that that's also the impression that they got being close to him, that really comes through, that maybe that is the way he is, and that was a problem.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is significant about what we wrote there and what the Newsweek reporters found here is, just as you say, it's not just a superficial impression, but people around him also found him to be a kind of a difficult figure. This is a very complex thing. He, although he has a history of being a selfless servant, and he really does, I mean, just look at the facts of what he has done, there is something about him that was a little whiny and a little petulant. Now, I think a lot of politicians who are under stress or under pressure and are used to having people cater to them can be whiny and petulant. He's not the only politician to behave this way, but he did behave this way, and it didn't endear him to people who were close to him, and it does give you a not great feeling about him. I think that Kerry is somebody for whom life is a bit of a struggle. He's not easy company. He's not somebody who's kind of relaxed and easy to be around. He's hard to be around because I think life has been a struggle for him in one way or another for a long time. I mean, he was sent away to these awful boarding schools when he was young. And not to get into pop psychology here, but his father was a cold and remote and pretty demanding figure. And there's just something about Kerry that's full of struggle. I mean, I remember one of his closest friends telling me, you know, and this is a guy who defends and admires Kerry, saying, I really don't know him. I just, there's something about Kerry you're never going to get inside of. Although he certainly has friends, is a loner. Was a loner on the campaign trail and was a loner in life.
There's a story that's told here in the book right near the end, and I think I'm hesitant to pull any one thing out and say that this explains everything. But it's very striking, and it's the story that after the election, one of your reporters was assigned to go to John Kerry's house and to talk to him, and did, and spent some time sitting and talking.
Yeah, that was me.
That was you. Okay. So, well, you can tell the story about what it is that happened when you were leaving and you were walking down the street and he came out after you with this note that had been left at his doorstep.
Yeah, this is an odd and, to me, affecting scene. I went over there. He called me up after the election, maybe 6 days after, to complain, really. He didn't like our treatment of him. He thought it was too harsh. And he said, come over and talk to me. And so I went to his house, which is in Louisburg Square, a very fancy part of Boston, and he's, you know, his wife has this enormous, beautiful house up there, and it was interesting. I mean, here he was alone. This is somebody who's been surrounded by an entourage and Secret Service and all that for months and months and months, and he opened the door. There was maybe a housekeeper somewhere in the house, but he basically was alone, and he spent a couple hours with me, and for a guy who just lost this very difficult election, his mood was pretty good. I had the sense that he was putting on a stiff upper lip, you know, putting up a brave front about it all and trying not to be too down about it. And he was also trying not to be too critical to me. I mean, he was mad about it, but he was not in any way kind of derisive or abusive or hectoring me. He was pretty polite about it all. And so we talked for a couple of hours and about this and that and political rhetoric and all that. And then when I was leaving, I was walking down the street there, and I heard somebody call out my name, and I realized it was Senator Kerry, and I turned around, and he was coming down the sidewalk holding this letter that a schoolgirl had left on his front stoop, talking about how great he was. It was a fan letter saying, Senator Kerry, you're the greatest and all that. And he wanted me to see this. So I'm standing there under the streetlight looking at it, and he puts his face up close to mine and says, well, you know, what is it that people don't like about me, that the media, that the pundits don't like about me? Is it my voice or, you know, the way I sound, or, you know, what, where I look? And I didn't know what the heck to say to him, and I just kind of shifted uncomfortably. And he heard himself being a slightly pathetic, maybe that's too strong a word, slightly forlorn, and stopped and smiled and, you know, shook my hand and went away. But it was a moment when he let his guard down a little bit, and there was something sort of sad about it, that he was trying to figure out what do I have to do here to persuade people that I'm a decent and a good person, and he was kind of clumsy about it at the same time, and it was just an affecting scene.
Well, it was also very clear in some of the comments that he made to you reporters all the way along through the election that he felt that he would be a better president than George Bush, and seemed not to understand why he was continuing to have to make the sale. Why he didn't close it on the first day?
Yeah, it was at one point in there, and I can't remember what it was, but at one point he said, "I can't believe I'm losing to this idiot," to his staff, because he thought Bush was kind of a dope. I mean, you have to go way back here to when they're both in college together. And they're students at Yale in the 1960s, and to carry George Bush is of a type that was on its way out, the kind of towel snapping frat brother, you know, practical joker, anti intellectual. That's how Kerry saw Bush, not a serious person. And the next thing you know, well, many years later, Kerry's running against this guy, and he can't beat him. And it just doesn't make sense to him. Kerry's a serious intellectual and thoughtful, you know, warrior even. And, you know, Bush was off serving in the National Guard defending Texas from Oklahoma. And Kerry's out there getting shot at. And Kerry sort of can't believe, how come I'm losing to this guy? And, of course, the answer, or one answer, is in what we have been talking about, these kind of ineffable qualities of character or personality that just Kerry couldn't do anything about.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Evan Thomas. He's written about Washington politics for a long time. He is assistant managing editor at Newsweek and has been since 1991. Before that, he was the Washington bureau chief. There is a book out now that brings together the reporting that Newsweek's team that covered the campaign did. It was published in the magazine, but now is available in a book form. It's titled Election 2004, How Bush Won and What You Can Expect in the Future, and it's published by Public Affairs. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line. Good any way that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have some callers here in Belgium over by Danville, nearby community, to start us off on the toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the focus back to the gentleman who's residing in the White House right now, and something that just seems to doesn't come straight with me. Here, Mr. Rather lost his job because of things he said about this gentleman that proved to be something less than provable. But yet nobody ever once said that Mr. Bush admirably fulfilled his National Guard responsibilities. He seems to have found a way not to show up for a lot of meetings. And I have an acquaintance that got to spend some time in Vietnam because he didn't do that. Somehow that just doesn't seem fair, and everybody just walks around the topic. They don't really mention the fact that he didn't do it. They just said that Mr. Rather didn't use the right type of research or whatever it was to prove it. Why didn't somebody pull him up and say, did you really or did you really not do your duty?
I think those questions were asked. This was not the first time that this had come up. It had come up in his gubernatorial campaigns in Texas, and it come up again in 2000 when he first ran for president. And there are some awkward questions here. I agree with you. It looks like Bush was, if he wasn't AWOL, he was not exactly doing his full duty. And I think those questions did get asked. But I think there are a couple of things. There's a couple of factors here. One is, Bush had a lot of company. There are an awful lot of people of my generation, I'm 53, who were shirking their duty one way or another to get out of Vietnam. A lot of people joined the Guard, and at the time, you know, it just wasn't taken all that seriously. So I think Bush gets, oddly, a kind of a sympathy vote from the vast number of American men who were in a somewhat similar situation, just trying to avoid going to Vietnam. And so, while they may not be proud of it, and they may even be disapproving of it, they empathize with him a little bit because they were in a similar situation. The White House has been fairly skillful about not really engaging on this. I mean, they put out a lot of paper, put out whatever records there are, but the records are touchy or incomplete, and Bush himself is really not ever really addressed what he was doing there. They've kind of ducked it. And as you say, gotten away with it. I think, just and back to my earlier point, I just think a lot of people just want to forget about Vietnam because their own records or their own lives were not profiles in courage at the time.
Well, the point I would like to point out, sir, what you're saying is absolutely right. But you, nor I, nor many of these other people want to hold down an office that puts other soldiers in harm's way, other Marines, other Navy personnel. If you are going to take this job, you surely ought to have the moral position that I've done what I should do if I volunteered to do what I was supposed to do.
Yeah,
I just can't see how Kerry didn't pull this up to him and say, look, you are wrong. You have done something that doesn't put you in a position to be a president.
Well, the proof is murky here. I mean, as Rather got himself into trouble for using documents that were not real. They were fake. They were false.
I understand that.
A journalist just cannot, especially a journalist of Rather's stature, just cannot do that. And Kerry never really had the goods. I think Rather, to Kerry's credit, he didn't smear or slime Bush with records that he didn't have. I mean, you could say that Kerry mishandled the Swift Boat thing, and I think he did. He should have stood up in a more forceful way to his Swift Boat critics who are accusing him of having a poor war record. But I think it was the right thing to do not to get too deeply into Bush's record, because he really didn't have the goods on it. These are all uncomfortable questions, and I think some people were bothered by it. And I hear what you say. How can you have the moral stature to send people into war to do their duty when you didn't use yours? Those are uncomfortable making questions. I can only repeat essentially what I said, which is a lot of people remember Vietnam as being a pretty ambiguous time, and that they too did something in retrospect that appears to be, less than their duty.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks.
Sure.
Just real quick to pick up on something that you said, or to take off on something that you said. It seems to me that this administration probably has been more adept at keeping media at arm's length and managing the news than any who have come before it. And that's saying something when you think about how that happened in the Reagan administration. Do you think that that's true?
Yeah. I mean, this is my world, and I have been around presidents since Jimmy Carter, and either in Washington or New York, mostly in Washington. And I would have to say the Bush administration is both the most skilled and the most kind of frustrating and irritating at keeping us at arm's length. I get mad about it, I get frustrated about it, but I can't say that it isn't a successful tactic. I mean, I think it's worked reasonably well for them to go over the heads of people like me and to the public and be less than forthcoming with us. I get cross about it because they can be downright contemptuous to us. I mean, I've had dealings with Bush people where they just are sneering about it. I mean, they just sort of say, hey, tough, go to hell. I can't get too indignant about it, however, because we're pretty rough with them. I mean, it's not like journalists don't write very critically and personally about Bush and the administration. I know I have, so I can't exactly whine about it when they just don't want to deal with me and they're a little bit rude about it. That's just, you have to sort of accept that's the way it is. And as I said, I can't say it's been an unsuccessful strategy. Bush's popular standing has not been hurt by his contempt for the mainstream media.
Let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'd like your reaction to two matters. One, Bush presenting the budget of $2.5 trillion, and then a week later he puts in the supplemental for $82 billion for the wars. And secondly, as reported on BBC, that contractors overseas were paid in cash without any accountability, and the explanation was, oh, well, we don't have any banking system over here. Your reaction?
I can't respond to the BBC report because I didn't hear it, and I'm just not knowledgeable enough. On your larger question about the budget, I support many things in the Bush administration, but one thing that I feel very critical about is his fiscal policy. And I sort of don't understand what happened to the Republic. The problem is, used to stand for some kind of fiscal control, restraint in the size of government, and they've thrown that away, as best I can tell. I just trying to make this tax cut permanent, a huge giveaway on medical benefits in terms of paying for drugs for the elderly. Their fiscal policy has been irresponsible in the extreme, I think. And maybe the economy will grow its way out of it, and we'll look back 10 or 15 years and just shrug and say, hey, it was okay. But but I think they're taking a big risk here, and I am full of skepticism about Bush's fiscal policy generally. His current budget, I've been in Washington long enough, and I never take the president's budget all that seriously. It's kind of an opening bid. It's never or very rarely what appears 9 months later, so I have a hard time taking all that seriously, but the specific budget he's introduced. But his general overall policy, I think, has been less than responsible. I think he's digging us into a fiscal hole that has larger consequences in terms of our dealings with the rest of the world and people's willingness to buy our bonds and our overall the health of our overall economy.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's talk with someone in Crystal Lake here, line number two. Hello?
Yes, hi. I think that saying that Bush just says something and then people believe it, that's true. But he, as a president, he should tell the truth. I don't think that's clever. I think that he should tell the truth. Everything he says is a lie, it seems, as a result. And even the presidential election, the outcome was a lie. And because the statistical analyst from the University of Pennsylvania professor said that actually Kerry won in Ohio by 52% against Bush's 49, and the difference of 3% being an this exit poll should have meant that Kerry won in Ohio, and instead it's possibility of the exit poll should jibe with the tallied polls if the tallied votes are counted right, and instead they were not counted right apparently. And even the Republican pollster Dick Morris said that the chance of exit polls being wrong, which would have, which instead of George Bush having the lead, it was Kerry had the lead. Kerry should have won in Ohio. And likewise, the possibility exit polls historically have always been right. And when there's a difference between exit polls being counted and tallied votes. They didn't jibe in this last election, nor the one before, for that matter.
Mm. Well, let me.
And it's a chance of it happening in all these battleground states was one that would have to be one in a million that all these things were wrong.
Yeah. Let's get a comment because I'm interested in what and Mr. Thomas would have to say about that, particularly about the question of should we expect exit polls to square up with the vote tallies.
Well, exit polls in the last two elections are just wrong, and not just in Ohio, but in other states as well. We know because on Election Day, most of us in the press were looking at those exit polls in the afternoon and thinking that Kerry had won. We made the mistake of believing those polls, even though we should have been warned by how off they were in 2000. The explanation for why exit polls are wrong that I've read recently, and I'm not an expert in this, but I'll just tell you what I've read recently. Interestingly, Republicans are less willing to answer poll questions for whatever reason. They just, when they're going into the polls and there's somebody there from ABC or from the networks, whoever is running the exit polls, ask them who you're voting for. Republicans are less likely than Democrats to answer. And as a result, it skewed the polls to make it seem like the Democrats had more of an advantage than they actually did. Exit polls are just flawed, and they're going to have to figure out how to do it better the next time around or just disregard them altogether.
That's an interesting subject. Maybe we'll have to try and go out and find somebody we can talk with about that. Other questions are certainly welcome as we continue to talk here with Evan Thomas. He is Assistant Managing Editor at Newsweek. We're talking about the election of 2004, and also we will talk a little bit about the next Bush administration and next what we can expect of the next couple of years in politics. And your questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One other thing that I'm interested in having you talk about, and again, this goes back to 2004. I think some people have made the criticism of the coverage, and I'm not just talking about Newsweek, I'm talking about news media coverage of the candidates in this way, saying that it seems that, and maybe it has something to do with the nature of incumbency and what you have to do as a challenger, but the criticism is that it seems that you have more opportunities to get some insight into the inner workings of the challenger, and perhaps that's because it's in his interest to do that, to provide that kind of access. A sitting president generally doesn't, And for that reason, perhaps there's a greater opportunity if something negative is going to come out, or you're going to form a negative impression, that in fact maybe it's more likely that that's going to happen with the challenger. And it has something to do with this issue of access and openness.
I think a fair criticism of the Newsweek election project, and this comes up every, as you say, it's not particular to this election, it's endemic. Generally speaking, you get more access to challengers than you do to incumbents. I mean, and when you think about it, it's not hard to imagine why. The White House is a pretty insular place. There are all sorts of walls erected. Challengers are, on the other hand, are looking for attention. They want you to pay attention, and then they have much looser campaign structures. I mean, just to try to visualize the difference between the White House press operation versus some candidate who's just getting going with a small staff and flying around and, you know, wants to be as available to reporters as possible, all that means that you do get somewhat skewed coverage. You do get more access to the challengers than to the incumbents. Now, we're aware of this, and in writing it, I tried to deal with it, and in reporting it, we tried to deal with it, but it is a fact of life, and I'd be disingenuous or naive if I didn't acknowledge that. And your point is also a valid one, that you may be more apt to find out critical stuff about the challenger because you have all this access. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, it can cut the other way. A lot of access can a lot of reporters have the opposite problem. They go native, so to speak. You can get too close. If you have a lot of access, you can get sort of sucked in by the candidate and become their friend or at least their ally. And that there's that risk, and that happens too. So you have to guard against getting too close to people who give you access, and by the same token, being too critical of people who are shutting you out. You know, I tried to factor in these human problems as I write, and to try to reach a balanced result. The reader can judge for themselves how successful I was, but I'm not unaware that this is an issue.
We'll talk next with someone listening in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to make a couple quick points here. You know, in talking about, you know, Bush and how the press portrays him versus, you know, actuality and their relationship, you know, from my point of view, you don't really have to. There's no skewing. I mean, when you look at him on camera, he is what he is. And he's kind of shown his true colors in how he handles himself. And that's, in my opinion, one of the most important aspects of a president, is how he presents himself to not only the American people, but the world. And if you just look at the debates, I think you'll find that, you know, if he can't compose himself and listen to a mediator in a debate, and if he can't keep his cool, what's going to happen when he sits down with prime ministers or North Korea in a serious conversation? And I guess that's my point. He's his own PR and America's, and you know, whether you agree with his policies or not, I think that's a major issue that he has to refine.
Yeah, I actually take a slightly different view of this. I agree with your basic premise that you sort of what you see with Bush is what you get. There is some truth to that, and I think a lot of people like that about him. There's a kind of a genuineness that, you know, he's not really hiding anything. In terms of him doing badly in the debates, though, does that mean he's going to do badly with, say, somebody from North Korea? I'm not so sure that's true. Bush has never been great facing the media and in these kind of Q&A, formal Q&A formats, and I don't think he thinks he's a great debater, particularly up against John Kerry. And I think he does worse in that setting than he would, say, in a one-on-one or a small group where he can use his people skills in a different way. He has considerable people skills. I've interviewed him, and I've interviewed Kerry. And Bush can be very winning in a small group, partly because you sense his genuineness. And his lack of his inarticulateness, which I think is a big problem in these debates, is less of a problem in a small group. He can sort of get across what he's trying to get across by his body language and his way of dealing one-on-one with you or face-to-face with you. So
right.
I draw a distinction between his ability or lack of ability on the debating platform and how he would deal with the foreign leader one-on-one.
Well, I guess my point has to do with, too, I've traveled all over the world, and it seems like America, the opinion of America, is not where it should be and across the world. So there is going to be attacks, verbal attacks, about, you know, what we're doing and how we're doing it all the time. And what I've seen is Bush cannot handle those attacks in a calm and reasonable manner. He gets emotional, and you're right, he is genuine, and he genuinely does get emotional. But, you know, when you can't even be held back by a mediator, and you say, no, I'm going to keep going whether you like it or not, you know, these are guidelines that we put in place as a viewing audience so that things don't get out of control. And from my view, I saw that.
I don't disagree with any of that, and I shared a little bit of your kind of, whoa, what's going on here? I've never seen him with a foreign leader, so how would I know? But what I've read about him, and both from, is that he does better. He was recently over there trying to put oil on troubled waters, and I think he, you know, partly because people underestimate him, including foreign leaders. You know, they think, oh, we hear this guy's a Dumkopf and an arrogant cowboy and all that, and then they meet him and he's not as bad as they think he is. So he defies the expectations. I think that has been, generally speaking, that's been Bush's experience. He does better with foreign leaders than you would think. I agree with you, America's reputation is pretty bad around the world. That's not because of the way Bush handles himself with foreign leaders, though. I think that's because the way he is when he's talking to reporters. He can be high-handed or sound like a cowboy. He's trying to restrain his rhetoric, I think, in the second term. In fact, he said something about it. He said that, you know, we've pointed to his wife objecting to his use of this kind of cowboy talk, and he said he was going to watch it, and I think he is trying to watch it a little bit more, and he is trying to improve America's standing in the world. America's standing in the world, the problems with it have much, you know, there are lots of causes for that. Bush is a cause, but there are many, many reasons why American standing is low in the world. It's a huge problem.
No, I understand. I mean, I also understand that a lot of issues that come about in a term have to do with the last 4 years, not this 4 years. And I understand, you know, a lot about, you know, American policy and, you know, where we've kind of gone right and where we've gone wrong. But I guess my point is, with all this religious fanaticism in the world, you know, causing these atrocities too, you know, it's hard to listen to a leader who bases most of his decisions in that respect. I don't think he bases them on basic logic. You know, a lot of it comes from his stomach, not his brain. And that's, and I'm not an anti-Bush hater or a left-wing fanatic. I'm right in the middle of the road, but I just see, you know, I didn't think one president really overtook me. I definitely was for Kerry, not Bush, but it's disenchanting to see in this day and age when we've separated religion and state so much that decisions are still being made from religion.
Well, I'm not sure Bush's decisions are being made from religion. He is a religious person and he reads the Bible. He does. There is, his rhetoric does sometimes make you think he's got a direct line to God. He has made a few quotes that make me a little bit uneasy. But really, my impression is that his decisions are formed for a lot of reasons. Part of it is based in faith, but part of it's based in political common sense. Part of it's his own notion of American strength and his own strength. I think there are a lot of factors that go into his decisions. I agree with you that at times I think, man, this guy's shooting from the hip a little bit too much, or this is a little bit too much viscera and not enough brain. But there are other times, frankly, when I think it's good that he's having an emotional or a visceral response. I mean, I go back and think of him standing on that rubble by the World Trade Center after 9/11, and I thought he looked pretty good then. And I thought he looked pretty good a few days later when he addressed the nation. And he was emotional and visceral, but as a citizen who was at home worried about what might come next, I welcomed his strength.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Evan Thomas. He's assistant managing editor at Newsweek and has written about Washington politics for a long time. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. When you look back to the things that George Bush said he would want to do when he was running the first time, the things that he said he would like to do if elected, it seems to me that the big among the big things, the things that he got were the tax cut, he got what has come to be called No Child Left Behind, and he got the Medicare prescription drug coverage. Now, we got a big deficit, and the tax cut seems to have something to do with it. A lot of people have concerns about just how well No Child Left Behind is working, and members of Congress are starting to balk at the price tag for the prescription drugs, and it hasn't even gone into effect yet.
Yeah.
There might be some other things you would point to, but I guess I wonder if, by their own scorecard, would Republicans say that the first Bush term was a success?
Well, Republicans do say it. I mean, because he got things done, and not only they were good things to do. I share all of your qualms about the things that you mentioned. I don't think the tax cut was smart. Certainly making it permanent wasn't smart. We had to do some kind of immediate fiscal stimulus, but I think it was too skewed to the rich, and it shouldn't be made permanent. No Child Left Behind, boy. Fixing American education is just an incredibly hard thing to do, and I'm not against this idea of trying to put accountability into it, but I think you have to recognize how extraordinarily difficult it is to do that. And on prescription drugs, we do need to take care of our seniors and our elderly, but the price tag is too high, and they got to find some way to rein that in. So all three things he did, in practice, have got problems. But to answer your question, do the Republicans think that that makes for a successful term? The answer is yes, because he did get those big pieces of legislation accomplished.
Hmm. Well, he has told us what he's interested in now in the second term, Social Security reform, continuing to have concerns about Medicaid. We're talking about tort reform. We're talking about tax reform, a lot of big things. And if the way that people on Capitol Hill have reacted to Social Security reform, even some Republicans, it makes you think this is going to be tough.
Yeah.
And you point out in the book, rightly so, that second terms are tough. You know, presidents, they're thinking about their historical legacy and the clock is ticking, but Congress, they're on a different clock. And you know, they expect to be there once the president is gone. So they have different sorts of concerns. And I know right now already people are saying, well, you know, we're not really sure we're going to get too much done with Social Security this year. If you push it into 2006, well, that's midterm elections. You don't expect anything to happen in that year. That makes you wonder, well, is it really possible that much is going to happen on this even in the next 4 years?
Yeah. Well, he's got an uphill struggle here on Social Security, no question about it. But I got to say, I'm rooting for him. I have my doubts about private accounts, that's such a smart move, but I have no question that we have these huge entitlement programs and an aging population, my generation, the baby boom generations coming towards retirement. Somebody has got to step up to these programs and start doing something to restrain their costs, or we're not going to be able to pay for them. And so I applaud Bush for at least stepping up to Social Security and saying we're going to take this on. I hope that there will be a compromise, that Congress, instead of just resisting and saying, well, there's no problem here and we don't have to fix it, which I think is the worst outcome, that there will be some kind of grand compromise or grand bargain at the end where everybody will give a little bit, including Bush on these private accounts, but that the Congress and the president and the government will take a meaningful first step towards dealing with entitlement programs that we can't afford as our population ages.
We have some other callers here. We'll try to get to as many as we can. First in line, Savoy, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
I compliment the host and the guest's objectivity and efforts to keep this discussion on topic, but it seems like most of the listeners that I've heard today have, for the most part, called to complain about the outcome and about George Bush. And given that this election was, in my opinion, largely about trying to elect for president somebody other than George Bush, it seemed a relatively simple task for the Democrats to come up with a candidate when there were so many people prone to want to just vote George Bush out. So if going off topic a little bit is one way to go with this discussion, I'm wondering your opinion or caller's opinions as to why the Democrats cannot produce a candidate that would have beat George Bush in the last election.
Well, I share your puzzlement here, because I said earlier in the hour that you know, Kerry didn't run a great campaign, but it's hard to think of who would have done better. I don't think Dean was the answer, and I, you know, maybe Edwards, because he's an attractive figure on the stump, but well, there were a lot of complaints that he was a bit of a lightweight and not ready for prime time, and he wasn't all that great as a vice presidential candidate, so I'm not sure he was the answer either. And this begs the larger question, is why can't the Democrats come up with a candidate who can talk to not just the coast, not just to the blue states, but to the country as a whole, or better reach there, speak in a language they understand, and talk about the values as they see them? And I don't have a good answer to that question. I also am puzzled by it. I'm an East Coaster, and one thing I do feel strongly is that the Democrats have catered a little bit to the so-called educated elites, i.e. people like me, and have neglected or have been a little condescending to the rest of the country, and that's hurting them. David Brooks, is a columnist for the New York Times, has written about this, that if the Democrats keep going in this direction, pretty soon they're going to carry Berkeley, California, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and nothing in between. I think that's a problem. There's something about the Democratic Party that has catered to the so-called liberal elites, which is resented by the rest of the country, and justifiably so, because there's real condescension or patronizing quality about it that the other people in the country pick up on, and it's just a killer for the Democratic Party. And ironic, because Democratic Party was, you know, famously the party of the people, of the masses, and FDR and so forth, and somehow they've lost that common touch. I'm speaking in very broad terms here, and there are many ways what I'm saying is not true, but there's something to it. And put it this way, the Democrats are not going to recapture the White House until they find a way to talk to people who live in those red states who feel patronized by the Democratic Party.
All right. I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's try and get one more. Crete, line number two. Hello.
I would ask Mr. Thomas to keep his eye on the new senator from Illinois. But besides that, the question that Kerry raised on his defeat was the video of Osama bin Laden just a few days before the election. Now, I know that probably doesn't carry as much water as Kerry would like to think, but that possibly was a turning point to some people, at least.
Yeah, I think it was a very important. I mean, it's hard to point to the one thing that turned the election, but that was a factor. At a critical moment for the Bush administration, it raised the specter of terrorism and reminded people that this is what the election was about, at least as defined by Bush, and, you know, gave people a good scare. Osama's a scary guy. He wants to kill us. And that was a helpful thing to Bush and a hurtful thing to Kerry. And I know within the Kerry campaign there are people who do feel that that's what lost the election for them.
I have a philosophy that says that there's a sort of a kill figure, that when we reach 2,000 or 2,500 or a My Lai incident or a Tet Offensive of some kind, that the American people are going to turn on Bush and devour him politically because of this war. We did it with Johnson in Vietnam, of course, and now when we get this magic number or this incident.
But what's the magic number? Because, you know, if you look at the history of the Vietnam War, public opinion didn't turn on Johnson. It didn't turn against the war until really 1968, and there were 20,000 American soldiers have been killed by then. By the Tet Offensive, I think the American death toll was around 20,000. That's a far cry from it's 1,200 or 1,400 or whatever it is now. I mean, my only point, I agree with you about a tipping point. I just think the tipping point in Vietnam was far, far, far away from what has happened so far in Iraq. And right now, things are looking better for the Bush administration in Iraq because of this election took a little bit of the heat off. I mean, not that Iraq isn't messy as all get out, and a lot of American men and women are dying there, but it ain't Vietnam, not yet.
Just to finish up on this point of what was there the turning point of the election, I guess I am struck by the fact that when you ask people who voted for each of the candidates what were the issues that were most important to you, and it was more likely that Kerry got the votes of people who said they were worried about the domestic issues, and that Bush won those people who said they were most worried about security and terrorism. And may just be that either there's the traditional association with security and Republicans, or the fact that people said, well, this is a dangerous time. We don't want to change administrations now.
You know, you can spend a lot of time trying to sort out all those things, and they're all interwoven. Because when voters vote, it's rarely for one clear, clean reason. It's often for reasons they can't even articulate. It's a melange of all these things. And I always mistrust these polls that try to sort out what the reason. I mean, there's a big to-do after the election that values was the big reason. Well, if you look closely at those polls, that doesn't really hold up either. And the problem with polling is it's trying to quantify that which is unquantifiable, rather vague reasons for which people vote. And I think have more to do with what we were talking about at the top of the hour, which is just the feel that people have for individuals, whether they like them or not.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to leave it for people who are interested in looking back to the last presidential election, maybe getting some insight into the candidates and the campaigns. You might look at this book that we mentioned that brings together the reporting that was done at Newsweek on the race, Election 2004, How Bush Won and What You Can Expect in the Future. Public Affairs is the publisher. Our guest this morning, Evan Thomas. He is Assistant Managing Editor at Newsweek. Mr. Thomas, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David.